This past Saturday marked 2 years since Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli sniper. She was on the job for Al Jazeera, covering an Israeli Defense Force raid on a refugee camp in the West Bank. Israeli officials have denied she was targeted. However, following her death, police raided her home. During her funeral, Israeli police attacked mourners, including the men carrying her casket. Abu Akleh was not the first journalist to die covering conflict in Israel, but it's seemingly prophetic. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 97 reporters have been killed since the October 7th Hamas terror attacks. The vast majority of those journalists were killed by Israel in Gaza. Akbar Shahid Ahmed is the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. He recently spoke at a memorial symposium for Abu Akleh at Arab Center, Washington, D.C. He joins us now. Hello, Akbar.
Hi, Ross. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell me a bit about what was discussed in the symposium.
We spoke about the legacy of Shireen and the importance of voices from within Palestine and how those voices are so often either smeared, cast as potentially extreme or dangerous and therefore vulnerable to attack. You know, in Shireen's case, it took a while, it took months for the Israelis to concede that, yes, an Israeli soldier fired a bullet, something may have gone wrong here. Initially, they were saying, well, there was a Palestinian bullet, you know, maybe in some ways sort of victim blaming, right? And to your point about this being prophetic with the Gaza war, what we've seen as Gazan journalists have, under incredibly trying circumstances, been broadcasting the stories of survival and the stories of what they and their communities are going through, you've seen efforts by, to some extent, the Israeli government, by others, pro-Israel voices to say, well, aren't these people maybe connected to Hamas? Aren't these people maybe suspect in some way? And that's something that creates this degree of vulnerability in this environment in which, as you mentioned, we're now close to 100 journalists who've been killed in this conflict. So we talked about the erasure of those voices, and we also spoke about simultaneously, as Palestinians are being deprived of the ability to tell their own stories, being unheard or misrepresented when they are doing that, simultaneously, the people who are telling the story of Gaza, who do have platforms on large media outlets, often are not telling it in a way that's sensitive or in a way that's accurate to the reality of the situation. And from my point of view, that's kind of three big reasons why that's the case that I'm happy to get into. And I think kind of that shape lacking international media coverage of the situation in Gaza and Palestine broadly.
Yeah, dozens of dead journalists create an information vacuum. So Western media has not really filled it at all and has only really done so with Israeli oversight. Al Jazeera was just kicked out of Israel. There's talk now that they might be kicked out of the West Bank as well. How does the story get covered? Is this where social media has been filling in some of the gaps with just regular folks on the ground telling these stories?
I think social media has been extremely powerful, right? We've seen TikTok be a huge platform, Instagram, you know, people like Mutaz, of course, established journalists, right? Like Wael Azadu from Al Jazeera. What's so interesting and in some ways heartbreaking, right? I think some listeners may remember when there was footage a few months ago now of a young journalist, right? Like she was a 7 or 8 year old girl who was sort of, she wanted to be the news reporter telling the story of her family and her community. So there's a real desire among Gazans to get those stories heard. I will say that there are good faith efforts by people in Western media to connect with Gazans, to elevate their voices, to hear from them, to the extent we can still reach them, right? And I think access is just a really important thing to remember. Number one, Israel has not allowed journalists to go, international journalists to go into Gaza. You've really only seen one, Clarissa Ward of CNN, be able to do that through the Egyptian border. And in recent days, Israel has taken over even Gaza's border with Egypt, right? So now they control even that. So if they say no journalists are going in, no journalists are going in. Access is a big issue. And then when journalists abroad, whether in Washington, whether in, you know, in New York or abroad or in Europe, right, or Asia, try and tell these stories and talk to Gazans, they bring those stories into newsrooms where often editors may have doubts about the accuracy of the story. There may be pressures to present things a certain way and say, well, is it as bad as the Palestinians are saying? Isn't there some, you know, credence we need to give to the Israeli point of view? of sports reporting has to represent all sides of a story and be fair, but you also have to be accurate, right? And being accurate is not always the same thing as saying both sides are equally correct in a conflict.
Yeah, and it seems like for Palestinians, information dissemination is means of survival, with the hope that if the rest of the world can see what is happening, that there might be action to do it. So far, that action really hasn't come from the important parties, especially the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. is the government, is the actor with the greatest possible say over Israel, right? No one else is able to make that call to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or the Israeli military and say, stop this or we will take away the American weaponry that makes your military campaign possible. I will say we've seen an unprecedented degree of dissent and discord within the US government and among foreign policy experts. Mm. And to some extent, that's a product of Gazans telling their stories in a way that US officials do see, right? Even if they're constrained from saying so publicly, they know it's happening. And I think that's creating a huge level of discomfort about what they are complicit in as American officials with the power to stop this, to stop the famine, to stop what President Biden has called indiscriminate bombing, and to not be stopping it.
Yeah, the U.S. State Department has been twisting itself in knots in press conferences. It's worthy of something from like Kurt Vonnegut or Joseph Heller in trying to tiptoe the line of supporting Israel while suggesting the IDF's actions have bordered on war crimes. How long before something gives, either at the United Nations or within the State Department itself?
I think you've seen already significant resignation from the State Department. I broke the news of Josh Paul, who was a veteran State Department official who quit early in the war. Since then, you've seen some other officials, most recently this week, an Army major who was at the DIA at the Pentagon. In terms of what I hear from my sources inside government, this moment we're in right now is a possible breaking point, right? So if Israel decides to go ahead with the ground invasion that it's talking about into this final refuge for Palestinians in Gaza, Rafah, then I think you would see potentially scores of people quit the department, right? Because they just feel, what am I doing here? I am on the brink of one of the worst catastrophes in not just history, but specifically in my field, right? Mm-hmm. Like, some of the greatest dissent has been from the U.S. Agency for International Development, from the people who are working on international law and human rights at the State Department. This is their expertise, right? They were trained to not let these things happen. How can they be in an office pushing the paperwork that either overlooks this or actively enables it? But it's a hard choice for us. I mean, it's a tough thing for people to give up the security of a job, the stability of an income, their field. Also, as we know, this is just such a politically complicated issue to be talking about in any way. And if you are someone who's leaving the U.S. government in this moment, regardless of whether you say you're doing it because of the Gaza policy, that's to some extent the implication, right? And you have to be ready to defend that potentially for the rest of your life. So it's a complicated thing for people inside government.
How much has this conflict, ostensibly between Israel and Hamas, hurt Israel's standing globally, and the U.S. for that matter?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it, and the toll, right, that foreign policy experts have been talking about. I was traveling in the Middle East in March, talking to Middle East and Europe in March, talking to Arab officials, European officials, and I do think we're on the cusp of a different kind of moment for Israel's existence in its neighborhood after it's done this. I mean, this is an incursion that's totally different from anything we've seen in now, you know, more than 70 years of Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. We haven't seen this kind of military campaign and this kind of mass killing, right? That's not going to be soon forgotten in Israel's neighborhood. I think many people, even inside the Israeli government and national security establishment, are aware that they're putting themselves at risk. And just something telling was in March when you had a U.S. official kind of tell the Israelis, look, you're taking a generational hit to your credibility. The pushback from the Israelis was very strong. So there is a faction within the government close to Prime Minister Netanyahu that says, we will prove that might is right and we are the strongest and you have to deal with us regardless. But a lot of officials in the US government, in the Israeli government, know that they're taking a hit. And not just a reputational hit, but kind of courting danger, right? I mean, courting resistance, courting anger, courting frustration. A lot of the discord that I'm hearing is from people working on counterterror and national security and this idea of, are we fueling more and more cycles of violence that we can't control because of this war?
HuffPost senior diplomatic correspondent Akbar Shahid Ahmed, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Russ.